Okay, recording started. Great. Thank you everyone for coming. This is the third and final shiur in the series on Tishrei and Second Temple Judaism. We've been learning the eighth parak, the eighth chapter of Nehemiah, which talks about the month of Tishrei, how it was commemorated, celebrated in a very momentous year. When Ezra and Nehemiah, through a joint effort, endeavored to recommit the Jewish population in Israel and in Yerushalayim in particular at the time to a Jewish lifestyle, to a Jewish allegiance that had both religious as well as political affiliations. They wanted the Jewish people to be Torah observant, and specifically to listen to the authority of the rabbis, to the Torah Shebaal Peh, to the oral law. The first week, we spoke about why Yom Kippur was not mentioned, because Yom Kippur highlights the everyday aspect of what the incredible Jewish life can be, and that was not the focus. The focus of Ezra and Nehemiah during this Tishrei was a watershed moment to recommit the Jewish people. And what we spoke about last week was about how Rosh Hashanah was not tshuva-centric. It didn't focus on details. Rather, it focused on a overall holistic gestalt commitment to God, to God's plan, and how commitment to that and the simcha that should be catalyzed through that commitment would eclipse and sort of smooth over all of the imperfections or shortcomings of the Jewish people at that time, at least in the short term, that there were shortcomings on the Jewish community. Intermarriage, for example, was a big one, but there were many things that they didn't know about Torah, or even the stuff that they did know, they didn't care about as much. And so it was to get them to recommit to that. But the first step, which was necessary, was not focusing on the details, but on the overall commitment to God and God's plan, and how rejoicing in that would give one's own life substance and meaning. That was what we spoke about last week. This week, I want to do the second half of the parak, the second half of the chapter, which discusses Sukkot, how the holiday of Sukkot was commemorated and celebrated. And interestingly enough, it actually starts on the second day of Rosh Hashanah. As we mentioned last week, the Jewish people on the first day of Rosh Hashanah came to hear Ezra read the Torah, and what they heard about made them feel despondent, sad, depressed. Whatever they learned about, it was clearly things that they were not up to snuff about. The second day of Rosh Hashanah, they come back to hear Ezra read the Torah, and here we do find out what they learned about. They learned about the holiday of Sukkot, and in particular, the mitzvah of Sukkah. So let's take a look. In source number one, this begins with Pasuk Yud Gimel, verse 13. It says, Uvayom Hasheni Nesfu Rashei Ha'avos L'chol Ha'am HaKohanim B'Halviim El Ezra HaSofer U'Lahaskil El Divrei HaTorah. So on the second day, the heads of the families of all the nation, of the whole nation, the Kohanim and the Leviim, they came to Ezra HaSofer to understand the words of the Torah. So just right off the bat, we see a distinction between the first day and the second day. The first day was everybody, men, women, children, people that could read, people that couldn't, as long as they could understand. Over here, now that we're focusing on details, we already see a distinction that the details will be only needed to be transmitted to the Rashei Havos, to the heads of the family, to the policymakers, as it were. We have buy-in from the masses, and once we have buy-in from the masses, now we can focus on the details with the elite, so to speak. So these elites came to hear what they needed to do. The Yimtzu Kasuv Batorah, and they found, for those of you that have come across the book of Malachim, Sefer Malachim, there's a story there where Yoshiyahu, the king, who was a boy at the time, after decades of anti-Torah monarchy, the king, as well as his wife, the queen, both of them waged a campaign against Judaism, against Torah scholars, against Torahs in general. And so when Yoshiyahu, who was 8 years old when he ascended the throne, they found in the Beis HaMikdash, they found a Torah. He didn't even know what it was. He had to ask the Kohen Gadol, what is this thing? And he said, oh, by the way, this is the Torah that you've heard about, but you never actually saw. So this language is echoing that, a rediscovery of Judaism. And so Vayimtzu Kasuv BaTorah, and again, maybe they knew, maybe it's meant to be figurative, that they didn't, they knew about the halachos, and it's meant to convey this imagery that they found this new grand idea, like Yoshiyahu, or maybe it is literal. Maybe they really didn't know. It could go either way. The Mefarshim have two different explanations. One, it's figurative. One, it's literal. But regardless, they found written in the Torah, Asher Tziva Hashem Biyad Moshe, that God commanded Moshe. And again, we have this chain going back to Moshe to establish a precedent, not only of Torah Shebichsav, of written Torah, but also a chain of Mesorah, of tradition that was passed on from sage to sage. So Moshe is the beginning, and the message or the idea that Ezra and the author of Ezra and Nehemiah is trying to convey is that it starts with Moshe, and now Ezra is standing in Moshe's stead as an emissary of God, in a different way, obviously, but Ezra is, so to speak, the new Moshe in town. So they found that God had commanded Moshe, Asher Yeshvu b'nei Yisrael basukos b'chag b'chodesh hashvi. They found that on the holiday of Sukkot, in the seventh month of Tishrei, they're supposed to sit in Sukkot. Va'asher yishmu v'yaviru kol b'chol areyim u'b'Yerushalayim, and so they proclaimed in all their cities, and in Yerushalayim in particular, tzu'u hahar, and we're going to read this pasuk very carefully, go out to the mountain, v'haviu alei zayis, bring olive branches, v'alei etz shemen, and oil trees, so maybe not olives, but other species of olive trees, va'alei hadas, and hadas leaves, or branches, va'ale tamarim, and date palm leaves, va'ale eitz avos, they translate, this is from Sefaria, they translated it as plated trees. It's hard to define what it actually is, but eitz avos, la'asos sukos kakasa, to make sukos as was written in the Torah. So some of these species that are mentioned should sound a little familiar to us. What do they remind us of? Where else do these species come up? Or at least some. Dalad Minim, yeah. So some of these, not all of them, we don't have olive trees associated with the Dalad Minim, but the Hadasim, the Tamarim, which are Lulavim, and Alei Eitz Avos, which we also say are Hadasim. So the Gemara will explain the distinction between. But we have Hadasim and we have Lulavim, but not for Lulav, to make a sukkah. At least that's the simple interpretation. So we're using some lulav ingredients and some non-lulav ingredients to make a sukkah. And they said, okay, we're going to launch this new campaign. We're going to go out and find all this stuff. We're going to mobilize all the Jewish people. And that's what they did. Everybody went out and they made sukkahs. They made on their roofs, on their courtyards, and in the house of Hashem. The Malbim explains the significance of this. He says that under normal circumstances, you're not supposed to have sukkahs in public domains. Now, the Gemara says, for various reasons, we're not supposed to have sukkos in public domains. The Chachamim didn't want that. The one exception was in the Beis HaMikdash, which was initiated by Ezra. That's what the Malbim posits, that Ezra initiated this idea of having a communal sukkah. Up until that point, everybody just had private ones. But again, as part of this general recommitment, we're now going to have one in God's house as well. So that's what they did. Uberchov Shar Hamayim, and again, another public one, not in the Beis HaMikdash, but even for people that were not going to the Beis HaMikdash, Uberchov Shar Ephraim, and in the main gate. Vayasu, and now here we come to a very interesting pasuk, which both the classical Mefarshim and the academics both say we can't take literally. It says, Vayasu Chol HaKahol HaShavim Min HaShevi. So all of the community that had come back from the diaspora, what did they make? Sukkos. They made sukkos. Vayeshvu basukkos, and they sat in sukkos. Kilo asu mimei Yeshua ben Nun came. And they hadn't done this since the times of Yeshua ben Nun, ben Yisrael, the Jewish people, ad hayom hahu, until that day, vatehi simcha gedolim od. It was a lot of simcha. So everybody, both the the classical Mefarshim, as well as academic scholars, say that's not meant to be taken literally, that people made Sukkos from the time of Yehoshua ben Nun. It wasn't this close to 1,000 years of non-Sukkah observance. Rather, what it means is they offer a couple of suggestions. One possibility is that it hadn't been celebrated on a communal scale, or it hadn't been done as a communal endeavor, meaning, according to the Malbim, the first time that they ever had a communal sukkah was at this point. The only other time the Jewish people did it together was when they hadn't settled the land yet in the times of Yehoshua. That's what the Malbim says. So he says that the innovation here was a communal observance. What many other Mefarshim and academics say is just it was the scale. Up until that point, especially during the times of the split kingdom, when you had the kingdom of Yehuda and the kingdom of Yisrael, and there was a blockade or an embargo on people making aliyah l'regel, that people couldn't, from the kingdom of Israel, go down to the kingdom of Yehuda. Or even before that, the Gemara and the Medrash say that in the times of Shmuel, Shmuel's father would make rounds, going around the Jewish community, encouraging people to be ola l'regel, to go visit the Beis HaMikdash during the times of Yom Tov. Because people weren't interested. People had lives. It wasn't safest because of the plishtim. There were many economic insecurity, and just people were lazy. They weren't interested in making a trek. So for financial, political, security reasons, they didn't go. So another suggestion is that they all did sukkos, but they didn't have a grand scale observance centralized in Yerushalayim up until that point. And that was the innovation of Ezra, a communal commitment to this mitzvah. And there was a lot of simcha. Then turn the page, the last pasuk. Vayikra b'sefer Torah sa'elokim yom b'yom min hayom harishon ad hayom ha'acharon v'yasu chag shivas yamim. So they made a seven-day holiday of Sukkos, and each day they read the Torah. What we do, we read the Torah every day on Sukkos, and they did too. Again, continuing this idea of Ezra teaching the Jews what to do, they now made a seven-day experience of it, under the guise or as incorporated part of a religious experience that had already been accepted by the Jewish people and was now augmented by Ezra's new enterprise of making it a communal idea. I don't think they read the Torah in Bavel. Whether they made Sukkos or not, again, it depends on how literal you take it. You could say that they really didn't do it. Or you could say, no, they did, just not everybody, not as a communal idea, or not, there wasn't this general thing that, oh, we're going to do Sukkos. It's just whoever felt like they wanted to be connected to Judaism. It really depends. It's a debate amongst the Mefarshim as to how literal we're meant to take that pasuk. Right. So, whether Ezra experienced it, we don't know. It could be that, he read it, he got it from his Masorah, from his tradition, from his Rebbe. He had his book. Right. Yeah, no, again, I'm not saying it's not. We just don't know. We just don't know. So that's the end of the parak. And then it says they celebrated Shmini Atzeres as well. The key takeaways, what did Ezra do? So we have Sukkos, we have sitting in the Sukkah, and we have reading in the Torah. There are two notable exceptions that we would normally associate with Sukkos, which are not mentioned or sort of not mentioned here. Luluv and Esrog, so the Dalid Ninim, and then another, Karbanos, yeah. We read in the Musaf and the Kriyas HaTorah talks about the Karbanos, and unlike Pesach or Shavuos, where it was the same every day, on Sukkos, they changed it up. It was a big ceremony. Every single day, they offered a different number. It was unique avoda. That's why we say a full Hallel, because it was a unique celebration every single day. That's noticeably absent. Again, it doesn't mean they didn't do it. We don't know. But that was not part of the tekes. That was not part of the celebration. And that wasn't part of the message that Ezra and Nehemiah were trying to give over both at that time as well as in this book to us. That's an interesting, yeah, that's a very interesting idea. That's a very interesting point. So it says they made sukkahs and it says they sat in sukkahs. It doesn't say that they ate in the sukkah. It doesn't say that they lived. It just says yashvu, they sat. And the reason why I think, I don't know, but I think is because that's meant to parallel the mitzvah as said in the Torah, right? They keep on referencing Torah's Moshe. And so what does the Torah say about the mitzvah of sukkah? Basukas teshvu shivas yamin. That includes many things, eating, drinking, sleeping, walking around, hanging out. But it's characterized under the rubric of sitting. And so I assume that's why it uses that language. But as I said, there are two notable exceptions, the Dalet Minim of shaking the lulav and esrog, as well as the karbanos. And if you see, very interestingly, there's a Gemara that links the two of them. If you turn the page to the last page, if you go to source number 10, it's a very short Gemara from Maseches Sukkah, Memhei Amidei's 45b. It says ve'otzeres ruchos utlalim ra'im v'amarava v'chein belulav. So the point of the lulav, Rava says, is it's supposed to help the Jewish people to stop harmful rain and dew. And then Rebbe Avahu says, in the name of Rabbi Eliezer, kol hamekayim lulav bi'agudo. Anybody who fulfills the mitzvah of lulav in its proper way, bound together, malel avakasav ki ilu bana mizbeach mehikriv karba. It's as if he built a mizbeach and he offered sacrifices. He built an altar and offered sacrifices. And so this Gemara doesn't reference the story of Ezra. This is just my own take. But it seems that what Ezra is doing is offering an alternative. By reading about the karbanos and being in a sukkah, it's as if he's saying, we're not going to be doing the lulav or karban thing as the main part of our celebration. Maybe they did it, maybe they don't. They didn't do it, I don't know. But clearly the Gemara understands that those two things are linked. And Ezra clearly did not want that to be incorporated as part of his message. Perhaps one reason, and again, it doesn't say, but perhaps one reason, we mentioned this last time, was that Ezra was not the Kohen Gadol. Ezra was a Kohen. There was a Kohen Gadol. There was a temple service going on. And this was meant to be, someone used the term breakaway. So I don't know if it's a breakaway or a rebellion, but it's clearly instituting at the very least, parallel method of service. We're going to read about Karbanos. We're going to read the Torah. We're going to learn about what to do. We're going to sit in Sukkos. Lulav and Esrog, Karbanos are not part of this. Another related reason is that there's a big distinction between Sukkos and Lulav, which doesn't impact us so much nowadays, but was very important during the time of the Beis HaMikdash, which was biblically, the mitzvah of Lulav is only the first day. But in the Beis HaMikdash, you were meant to do it every day. So nowadays, some people that live in Yerushalayim, they have a custom of going to the Kotel or getting as close to the Beis HaMikdash as possible so they can shake lulav and biblically fulfill the mitzvah of lulav every day of Sukkot. That's why some people, they have a custom of davening by the Kotel every single day of Sukkot if they live in Yerushalayim. Well, it doesn't give the proper date. I don't know if I would, you know, I don't have a reason to suspect that they wouldn't. If they're going through the Torah and they're referencing it, I assume then because the Torah gives us a date, they followed it, but that is a possibility. But what I do think that Ezra is saying is that lulav, karbanos, that's a Beis HaMikdash thing. That's a 7-day Beis HaMikdash thing. You guys only need to do this one day. You don't even need to do the karbanos at all. We're gonna focus on things that the entire Jewish community can relate to and participate in. We want them to participate in the Beis HaMikdash, right? Everybody came to hear the Torah. They had a sukkah there. But the activities that they were doing, even in the Beis HaMikdash, were non-Beis HaMikdash activities. Yeah. Means different, yeah.
It's different, and it's because they don't know where it's from. You know, I mean, it's almost like, and like the best parallel between those is, you know, people who are really isolated, like Russians or things like that, who never really experienced Sukkot or other things, but then they chose Simchas Torah as their like holiday. That was like what they wanted, because there was joy associated with it. Well, Ezra is doing the same thing. He's like, I want you to be happy. I want you to like Judaism. Like, let's like forget about like the minutia and like all the details, and let's get you to be vested in it. And then we'll start like doing all the like, other things. And that's why maybe they choose the elders. But this is like Kiruv.
Yeah, I think that's a great description, that this was a Kiruv enterprise. And they did things that everybody could connect to in a very easy way that wasn't so demanding, that wasn't so intricate. And as we'll see, a sukkah can be built with anything. Yeah, it has to be something that grows from the ground. It has to be detached. But you can use pretty much any material that's organic for schach. And you can use any material you want for the sukkah, as opposed to lulav, which is very specific. What's interesting, and again, this was to make life easy, enjoyable, make Judaism palatable for people. If you take a look in source number 2, there's a Gemara which actually says that they use this story to tell us what materials can be used for a sukkah. And some say that actually the materials have to be the same ones and only the same ones that you can make a lulav out of. That's the opinion of Rev Yehuda. Of Rev Yehuda. So if we look in the Gemara, in source number 2, it says, Basukas Teshvu, you're supposed to dwell in a sukkah. So the Gemara explains, sukkah shall call davar, could be made of anything. Divrei Rabbi Meir. That's the opinion of Rabbi Meir, and that's what we hold by. Rev Yehuda Omer, Rev Yehuda says, Ein sukkah nohegas ela ba'arba minim shebelulav. The sukkah can only be made for material that is kosher for a lulav. And he has a very interesting source. He says, v'hadin nosein, it's logical. I can derive this logically through a kal v'chomer. Uma lulav she'ein noheg balelos kibayamim. The mitzvah of lulav is only applicable during the day. And ein noheg ela b'arba minim. And even though it's only applicable during the day, you can use a very limited number of species, 4 species. Sukkah she'noheg es balelos kibayamim, a sukkah which is, so to speak, more stringent because you have to do it all the time. So he says, well, then obviously it should be only made of these 4 species. That's a very interesting alvachomer. You could debate the logic. And the biggest argument that I would put forth is, well, they're 2 completely separate things. Why would, you can only make a kalvachomer. You can only make a logical inference if there's some commonality between them. And so it must be that according to Rev Yehuda, there is a link between Sukkos and Lulav, and the Chachamim, which are going to disagree and don't say what I said, they don't disagree, we'll see in a moment, but they don't disagree because they say they're 2 completely separate things. They actually advance a very unique argument. It must be that the Chachamim also agree that even though you can use whatever material, there is some underlying connection between Sukkos and lulav, and that's why they used at least some of the same material, even though they didn't have to. So why do the Chachamim disagree? Why does Rav Meir disagree? Why can we use anything? And they say, Kol din sha'ata don chilaso lahachmir v'sofo lahakel eino din. Anytime where a chumra becomes a kula, where anytime you try to be stringent and you end up being lenient, that's not a valid logical inference. So they said, if you follow Rav Yehuda, then you can come up with theoretically a very interesting scenario. Lo matza arbas minim. If you don't have those 4 materials, yehe yoshev ubatel, then you won't have a sukkah. V'atora amra basukkas teshvu shivas yamim. So their argument is, yes, they do have stuff in common, but if you follow it to the nth degree, then you'll end up missing out on sukkah, the mitzvah of sukkah, and the Torah clearly says you need to do this. And so it must be that the material list is much more expansive. Again, a very interesting way of debating it. But what they're trying to say is The Torah clearly wants the sukkah to be applicable to everybody. Again, Ezra made the sukkah applicable to everybody. And in order to do that, we have to take a more expansive view of what materials can be used. And even though I would ideally want to have the same materials as the lulav, which again, clearly they did, according to the simple pshat of Ezra, nevertheless, Ezra went out of his way to say, also bring things to make it more expansive and more applicable than lulav. And then the Gemara continues and says that Rabbi Yehuda understands the verses and Ezra and Nehemiah differently. But the Gemara says, our Gemara is a source to take a more expansive view of the mitzvah of sukkah. So clearly they're linked, but sukkah is different and more expansive than what lulav symbolizes or accomplishes for the Jewish people. The Gemara, according to this opinion, actually interprets the verses in a very interesting way. It says that when Ezra told the Jewish people to go hunting for material, the non-sukkos materials were meant to be for the sukkah, and the sukkos materials were actually meant to be for the lulavim, even though that's not the simple reading of the verses. So it like thumb twists to give a very unique read against the simple interpretation to go out of its way to say they used non-lulav material for sukkah, but we clearly wanted to have it phrased and spoken about in a way that makes it seem like there is a link, just not a very strong link. And that's what I'd like to kind of explore with you a little bit, which is, what do they have in common? How are they different? And why was that difference important to Ezra? Which we already began to allude to make it more applicable. There seems to be a connection, but sukkahs exist on a much more fundamental, rudimentary level of Jewish life than what the lulav accomplishes. To get to that distinction, we turn to a very interesting person, but it's based on a medrash. If you turn the page, there's a medrash Tanchuma in source number 4. The medrash Tanchuma says, "Ulekachtem lachem b'yom harishon." You should take for yourselves on the first day. And that's the beginning of the pasuk about lulav. You're supposed to take all these ingredients for a lulav. So the Gemara asks, the Medrash asks, is it the first day? It's the 15th day of Tishrei. So why does it say the first day? So what would you answer? The first day of Yantif. Yeah, that's what I would say. That's what everybody would say. The Medrash doesn't say that. The Medrash says, Ela Rishon Hu L'cheshbon Avonos. It's the first day of the accounting of sins. And then the Medrash continues and says that the Klal Yisrael asks for forgiveness on Rosh Hashanah. The righteous people fast. God forgives it partially. Then on Yom Kippur, everybody fasts and God forgives them even more. And then on Sukkot, they take their lulavim and says, okay, God says, great, you're all forgiven. Now we're starting from scratch. Now the sins can begin. Now you shake lulav. Now the sins can begin. The lulav is the final step of the transition point to when the Jewish people begin to start sinning again. It's very interesting, very graphic medrash in that sense. But what you all said is there's a much easier answer than this medrash. You could just say it's the first day of Yom Tov. And you're not the first person to ask this. The first person that we know of that asked this is quoted by the Beis Yosef. His name was Rav Yitzchak de Leon. Rav Yitzchak de Leon was born in Seville. He was Spanish, and he lived right before and at the point, he was an older man, by the time of the expulsion from Spain, he was a venerated Talmud Chacham and Kabbalist, and he was bothered by this. So the Beis Yosef quotes him. We don't really have many, I don't know if we have any of his Sfarim, but his students and his grand students quote him. So the Beis Yosef quotes him, and Rav Yitzchak de Leon gives an answer. If you look at the bold part, Mipnei Sheba Osa Parsha, we'll look back in a second. In that section of the Torah, Hevi Shlosha Inyonim, there are three elements that are mentioned. Sukkah, the mitzvah of sukkah, v'chagiga, and the mitzvah of celebrating the holiday with sacrifices or with rejoicing, v'lulav and lulav. V'gazar hakosav b'sukkah shetia b'chamisha asar v'gam chagiga. And the way that the Torah phrases it, we'll see in a second, is that the sukkah and the chagiga are supposed to be celebrated on the 15th. V'imkein, balulav hayalalichtavkein. So from a literary standpoint, the parallel structure bit should have been preserved. So yes, technically, the simple interpretation is the first day of Yom Tov. But if we go back and look in the sources for parallel structure for conformity's sake, it should be phrased the exact same way. And the fact that it didn't gave the Medrash pause, which caused them to give this very homiletical interpretation. But what emerges is that there are different elements of the holiday of Sukkot, and they exist at different planes. There's the mitzvah of Sukkah and the celebration, and that's on the 15th. And then there's another mitzvah, which is on the first day, and that's lulav. And the Medrash picks that up. It says it's the first day of sins. So the imagery of first implies they're connected, but they're two different things. Sukkos and rejoicing and simcha, that's a culmination. That's the 15th. That's when the moon gets full. That's the end of the Tishrei experience. And the lulav is connected to that, but that's the beginning of something new. It's similar. They happen on the same day, but it's something new. This idea was developed by a person. His name was Rav Yoel Kahn. He was one of the primary students of the late Lubavitcher Rebbe. He deals with this a little bit in a certain angle. But there are really two elements of the holiday of Sukkot, and one is a culmination of the Rosh Hashanah experience that started on Aleph Tishrei and ends on the 15th, or the holiday of the 15th. So Sukkot is a culmination of Rosh Hashanah. So they read about Sukkot on Rosh Hashanah, and they ended by building the Sukkot on Rosh Hashanah, on Sukkot. So in a certain sense, the actualization of the vision of Rosh Hashanah occurs or culminates on Sukkot. Then once I have that, there's another element of Sukkot that's going forward, that's forward focused. That's something new. That's lulav. So what do they have in common? And what are the differences between Sukkot and lulav? So one commonality is the theme of achdus. And I know that sounds very fluffy and abstract, but it comes up in halacha and as well as in many literary contexts as well. We say in sukkah, we say in davening, ufore sukkah shalom aleinu, that a sukkah is associated in Tanakh with peace. Why is a very interesting question, but I think the simplest answer is that a sukkah is a tent, and a tent, especially back then when people were going out on business trips or living with various flocks, living together in packs, it was meant to house in an ad hoc way different people. The Vilna Gaon, in his commentary to Esther, he says that shalom means peace, and peace doesn't mean that everybody's the same. Peace means a framework in which differences can coexist in a sustainable way. And so there's a lot of differences. And when we say that God spreads his sukkah of shalom, it means there's different people and God unifies them by creating a framework or creating a tent where everybody can coexist in a peaceful fashion. This comes to at least a mention or an allusion to in the Gemara in Sukkah in source number 7. In source number 7, it talks about whether you can borrow a sukkah, right? Are you allowed to use someone else's sukkah? So we know that on the first day of Sukkot, when lulav is a biblical obligation, you are not allowed to use someone else's lulav. Rather, they have to give it to you. You might have to give it back. But you can't borrow a lulav. You can't borrow someone's lulav. That's why giving it to a child opens up a Pandora's box of halachic problems, because children can give, but they can get, but they can't give, because they have the maturity to take something. They don't have the maturity to give something. But does that exist by sukkah? Can you borrow a sukkah? And the answer that I'm sure you know is yes. We go to people's sukkahs and we make brachos throughout Yom Tov. So there's a difference, but it's a machlokas. It's a debate. There's a brisa. In source number 7, Rabbi Eliezer says, no, just like you can't borrow a lulav, you can't borrow a sukkah. And he tries to explain it from sukkim. The chachamim argue, in the bolded part, they say no. Even though you can't share a lulav, they say you can share a sukkah. How do I know that? And again, you could just say, because they're two separate things. One has nothing to do with the other. No, they're linked, but the Torah says there's an exception. If the last, the second to last line on the bolded part, Tichsiv, Kol ha'ezrach b'Yisrael yeshvu basukos. All of citizens of Israel shall dwell in sukos. Now, it's plural, but it's written chaser. It's written without a vav. And so the Gemara darshens and says that it means even a single sukkah. Melamed, this teaches us, shekol Yisrael ru'uyim leishev b'sukkah achas. Theoretically, the entire Jewish people could sit in one sukkah. So we have one distinction between sukkos and lulav, which emerges from a theme of achdus. We'll see the lulav also has elements of achdus, but a sukkah has achdus, so much so that even though it's connected to a sukkah, to a lulav, nevertheless, the Torah goes out of its way to say, no, you can share, you can join together in a sukkah, and the entire Jewish people could theoretically sit in one sukkah. And again, that's what Ezra was trying to do. Ezra made this national sukkah in the Beis HaMikdash, and he made another more political or provincial sukkah in the town square. So we had the holy one, we had the mundane one, but there were national sukkahs. We don't have a national lulav, so Ezra didn't make a celebration out of it. Everybody's got to have their own. Here we can get together. So that's the element of achdus that a sukkah has that creates a distinction between sukkos and lulavim. But lulav also has an element of achdus. If you look in source number 8, it's on the next page. This is, many of you may be familiar with this. I'm not going to read it completely inside just because it's too long. But it goes through all the four species of the lulav, and it says that they parallel different types of Jews. So the esrog has a nice smell and a nice taste. So that parallels people that have Torah and mitzvahs. A lulav has a nice smell but no taste, so that parallels people that have Torah but no mitzvos, and the hadassim are that. The lulav has a taste but no smell, so that parallels the other, somebody that has mitzvos but no Torah, and then the aravos are for the shegitzes, so to speak, the ones that don't have either Torah and mitzvos. So what are you supposed to do with those people? So look at the end of the bolded part. At the bolded part, it says, "Umar Kadosh Baruch Hu Osalem." What does God do with those people? Those are aravos, those people that have no Torah or mitzvos. La abdon efsha. He can't destroy them. Ela Umar Kadosh Baruch Hu yikasher chula maguda achas. Everybody should be joined together, make a lulav together. Vehein mechakrin elu al elu, and they'll atone for each other. Even the esrogim. Even the Esrog, the one that both has Torah and mitzvahs, apparently they also need atonement. So there's a lot of homiletics as to why that is, but it's a joint effort. It's a joint effort to achieve kapara, to achieve forgiveness, in order to get the ball rolling forward, to moving from the Rosh Hashanah experience to the rest of the year. You need to include all the different types of Jews. You need achdus. But there's a big difference between the nature of the achdus of the lulav and the nature of the achdus of a sukkah. What are some of the differences, both the literal and the metaphorical one? What are some differences of a lulav versus a sukkah? The achdus of a lulav versus the achdus of a sukkah. Mm-hmm. So all of those are very important differences. So one is, by the lulav, we're focusing on the differences. We need those differences to work together. By a sukkah, it's almost as if those differences are eclipsed by a broader unifying factor, by the sukkah, by God. If you pledge fealty to God's plan, if you commit to God's plan, so okay, this difference, that difference, this guy's better than that person, that doesn't matter. But by lulav, it does matter. We need those differences in order for it to operate effectively. For the sukkah, we downplay the differences. Another distinction is, as you said, whether everybody needs to be together or not. By a sukkah, you only fulfill the mitzvah of sukkah if you're in the sukkah. The achdus is only manifested if you're in the same sukkah together. By a lulav, however, that's not true, strictly speaking. There's a machlokas in the Gemara. There's a debate about whether you need to have the lulav physically bound together or not. And the way we paskin, the way we hold, is that you don't. You don't need to have them all unified together. If you look in source number 9, the Rambam says, this is the opinion of the Rambam. There are distinctions between the Rambam and others, but the Rambam, I think, is the most visceral opinion. He says that ideally, they're all supposed to be bound together. That's the mitzvah min hamuvchar. That's the best because it's all one mitzvah. It's all one entity. But the Rambam, after the two dots, after the second two dots, he says, v'im lo agdam, if you didn't bind them together, unetalon echad echad, and you take them one at a time, v'hu sheyu arba mitzuyin etzlo, as long as they're next to you, that's okay. You could have all of those differences, but as long as they're, and they don't even have to be unified. As long as they're right near each other, that's okay. The differences can manifest itself. Aval im lo ela min echad, but if you're missing one, if it's not there, then you got nothing. If they're there, they don't have to be together. They just have to be at hand. They have to be nearby. If they're nearby, you can have all the differences you want, your yotzei, and you need those differences to be yotzei. By a sukkah, if somebody's outside the sukkah, they could be as close to the sukkah as they want. They're not fulfilling the mitzvah, and there's no achdus because you're not sharing the sukkah. So that's another distinction, that there's sort of a kula and a chumrah. And again, that's what the chachamim were arguing about in that previous gemara, that there's an overlap between the two, but there are distinctions that create stringencies and leniencies by both. They're different. Yeah. That there are two kind of tracks. One is very expansive in the sense that all the differences don't matter. You can use any material you want for a sukkah. You can be unified in one big sukkah, but that's because you're all in the same building and you're essentially being eclipsed by something bigger than you, God's sukkah. Right? The mitzvah of sukkah is not really doing much. It's just being in God's sukkah. As opposed to the lulav is a much more active thing. We're doing something. We're shaking it. We're taking it. We're binding it together. The differences, the human initiative is much more manifested, but, and even those differences can come to a head, even if they're not literally physically joined, but it's much more restrictive in the sense that you can't share it. Everybody needs their own. Again, differences are manifested. And moreover, in addition to those differences, it's a much more limited repertoire of things you can do to fulfill the mitzvah. It has to be four species. That's it. Those four and nothing else. Yeah, exactly. You could use whatever you want. If God is the shelter and God is the unifying factor, we don't focus on those differences and it can tolerate a lot more. The moment we become more active, the more we want our individual differences to actually function, it becomes much more circumscribed. We need very specific things, and they have to be very individual. You can't share. And so that is one of the messages of Sukkot, of faith of God, of what Ezra was trying to convey to the Jewish people, that the vision of Rosh Hashanah, that plan of recommitting to God, we don't care about all those differences, whether you're intermarried, whether you're not intermarried, whether you keep Shabbos, whether you don't keep Shabbos. As long as you say, my differences don't matter, I'm just focused on God and I'm happy about it, then anybody can come. The only requirement is to be in the sukkah. And that's the baseline. That's the culmination. That's the holiday of the 15th. The first day, the Yom Rishon, the going forward, that's where things get a little bit more complicated. That's, so to speak, the morning after. That's the ninth parak of Nehemiah, when Ezra starts saying, okay, now we gotta separate from all our intermarried women. Now we've got to start using some muscle. Then we got to start asserting differences, and we need those differences. We've got to work together. We got to do this. But the moment human initiative starts to creep in, it becomes much more rigorous, much more detail-oriented. Just to highlight this a little bit more, in source number 11, this is a practice, again, a very, very visceral image, that Rav Acha bar Yaakov, Mematale Umasile, he would wave his lulav around and he would say something. So we say Hoshanas, we say Hallel. What did he say? He said, Dein Gira Be'enei Desitna. So this is a thorn or an arrow in the eyes of the Satan. Again, taking on mitzvah observance, I'm getting the satan. No, no simcha here. We're not going to talk about simcha. We're not talking about happiness in God. No, this is adversarial. This is war. Sukkah is peace. A lulav is a weapon. They're two different things. But then the Gemara says, I don't like this. Lav milsehi. This was not the proper thing to do. Mishum da'ase legruyebe. You're inciting the Satan. You're goading him on to get you to sin. You're putting up a fight. You're looking for a fight. Yeah, I think that, again, they are clear. It is clearly linked to the Tishrei experience, to the Rosh Hashanah experience. It's on the same day, but it's the step after. The sukkah is peace, is everybody coming together. It's God. The lulav is now saying, okay, let's weaponize this. Let's do something about it now. And the Gemara says, that's fraught with challenges. It's fraught with challenges in the sense that when your differences, when human initiative comes to the forefront, it's got to be circumscribed. It's got to be limited. It's got to be individuated. You have to be careful and calculating. So those are the differences. And that's why Ezra and this parak don't focus on the lulav and on the karban, the taking on. And the karbanos, I don't have the source here, but there are 70 karbanos that are brought over the course of Sukkot. And the Gemara says it parallels the 70 nations and it's poches v'holech. We do less karbanos each and every day to show that we're offering sacrifices on behalf of the nations, but we want to attenuate their power and assert the primacy and the authority of the Jewish people. So it's a universal holiday, but it's a universal holiday on our own terms. Right. And so once again, that's what the Gemara is saying. There is a link between the lulav and the karbanos. It's humanity giving to God. It's humanity taking the initiative, and it's the Jewish people asserting their dominance of their lifestyle on their own people and on the rest of the world. That was not part of Ezra's message on this day. That was not part of Rosh Hashanah. That's a different thing. They're connected. They're part of the same process of unifying the Jewish people, of getting close to God, but they're different steps. We need both, but they're different steps. Yes. So he didn't say... So I think he implied it. And then in the next chapter, when he starts... then telling them, okay, we got to divorce these women. We got to, yeah. Yeah, so again, there were elements of both, but that initial celebration, he was trying to be nice and happy and make it fun. Then once you have your foot in the door, then we start, you know, then we start driving you, yeah.
And yet, once you start doing the Lulav and Ezra, that's like a personal experience with God. So you're together praying, but yet you're supposed to be content. And you're not supposed to borrow, you know, you're not supposed to rely on someone else to pray. You're supposed to actually be participating in that praying. So it's like an echo of the same thing. And what's interesting is it's something tangible. Whereas
the mitzvahs.
Right. Like when mitzvah becomes tangible, you're more invested in it. When a mitzvah is less tangible, that's why some people have trouble with prayer about korban and everything else, because like it's very ethereal. But when you actually have a lulav and asrog, and that's why parallel is, it's a substitute for korban, because all of a sudden this is tangible. Like this is like, if we do a really good job at this, this is korban.
Yeah,
it's a very interesting, like, you know, elevation of from the mundane.
I completely agree with you, and I think, like you said, the reason why it links the lulav to karban is because the Gemara was written in a time where there were no karbanos, and the mitzvah of shaking the lulav all 7 days was instituted as a zecher lemikdash, to remember what they did in the times of the temple. So, like you said, that they're trying to say, This is the internal personal element of the Yom Tov of Sukkot, and we do that by taking an abstract idea or some, you know, call back to a bygone era and making it a very tactile, engaging experience on a very individuated level. And that does parallel the two elements of Rosh Hashanah. So that was that all 7 days outside of the Beis HaMikdash was much later during the times of Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai, in times of the Gemara, meaning as a callback to what they did in the Beis HaMikdash. Now that we don't have one, we do it all 7 days. But again, anybody who came to the Beis HaMikdash could do it all 7 days, anytime. So that I assume they did, but I don't know. I want to close. We have about 10 minutes. So in the last few moments, I want to show you how, even though we hold, even though we paskin that you use different materials, clearly what we've seen is that there is a link. The psukim, the sources, are the same sources. The underlying assumptions of a link are present, even in the opinions that say there are differences, because we have to come up with all these very minute, homiletical, metaphorical reads of verses that go against the simple interpretation in order to say why I don't compare Sukkot to Lulav, which implies that there is an underlying connection. This was popularized by a minhag of Hasidim, which started by the Arizal. If you turn back to page 3 in source number 6, this is an excerpt from the Sefer of the Pri Eitz Chaim, which was written by Rav Chaim Vital, who was the foremost student of the Ari, Rabbi Isaac Luria, who's a major figure in the world of Kabbalah in the 1500s. And again, the Beis Yosef, who quoted Rav Yitzchok de Leon, who established that link, they were all contemporaries, or near contemporaries. So they all lived in that same community. So Rav Chaim Vital says in the name of his Rebbe, Tov levarech tchila kodem hatfila. It's ideal to make a bracha on the lulav before davening. Biyoscha bebeischa besukkah atzma. There's an idea of shaking the lulav in the sukkah, even though everybody agrees the actual mitzvah that we fulfill when we shake the lulav takes place in shul when we say hallel. That's when we're supposed to do the mitzvah of lulav. Nevertheless, the Arizal said, there's a very big inyan, there's a very important factor of shaking the lulav in the sukkah, of taking all of those individuated, weaponized differences and bringing it into the sukkah of peace. Essentially using it and bringing it into that framework of unifying those two tracks and saying, once I have a sukkah, once I built the sukkah, the best place to use the lulav is in a sukkah, is to combine those two tracks. And if you look in the last source, Rav Nachman Mibreslov in Lukutei Halachos, where these are teachings of Rav Nachman and his Talmud that are arranged according to halacha. They're Kabbalistic and metaphorical and Hasidic ideas based on halacha. So in the section, it's actually in the Rosh Hashanah section, but when he talks about lulav, he says, V'al yidei lulav, shehu b'chinas vav, a lulav, which, you know, it's like a vav, it's like a long stick, and a vav or a stick connects things, it links things together. So the lulav acts as a link, makashrin osan, it unifies all of those peoples and objects that are removed from Kedusha, from sanctity. That's what he's talking about. Lebechinas nekuda helyona, to that most lofty place, shehu bechinas sukkah shalem, which is the sukkah of peace. And that's why we do that. We bring the lulav into the sukkah because the lulav is the weapon. The lulav goes out. It takes all those differences and we bring it into that framework of peace, of eclipsing those differences, of unifying it by commitment through happiness to God. Which he says, it's like a mother who watches over her children, who protects her children. That's what the sukkah is. Not the lulav. The lulav is a weapon. The sukkah protects and nurtures. So the lulav is supposed to be a hook. It's supposed to drag people, not bring people. Ezra brought people in through happiness. The lulav weaponizes and stabs things like a poker and drags it into the sukkah. It elevates all of the holiness in the world. When we say on Sukkot, it rebuilds the house of David. Essentially, it brings Mashiach. And then humanity becomes perfected. To sit, as it were, on God's throne. And then what happens? then Israel can sit in judgment on the rest of the world. That's what the Gemara says, that ultimately Sukkot is a day when all of the nations will acknowledge God's sovereignty and Israel's sovereignty. That's why we bring all of those 70 karbanos and our poches v'holech, bring less and less to mitigate the power of the nations of the world. And so once again, he establishes this link between the karbanos and the lulav of attacking and subjugating. But he says, that's one track. And it's not only that it's supposed to happen afterwards, like Ezra and Nehemiah, it's supposed to happen in concert with each other. There are two separate things that are supposed to happen on the same day. And the most ideal form, according to the Arizal, is when they're done together. And as we've seen, there are different approaches to Jewish revivalism. In some ways, it's much more open, much more tolerating differences. As long as you're pledging yourself to God, as long as you're in the sukkah, so we don't care about the differences. The other approach is no, it's attacking, it's adversarial. It's celebrating our differences and saying, no, those differences inform an individual avodas Hashem. I can't use your lulav. My way is different than your way. And we don't even have to be unified together. As long as we're right near each other, that's okay, because the differences come out. And ideally, those two are supposed to work together. And that's what Ezra did. He focused right now on the first part, on making Yiddishkeit appealing, of saying how important God is. Let's care about the differences later. And then the lulav comes in, so to speak, and Ezra starts weaponizing the Jewish people, of weaponizing the muscle that Nehemiah brought to start creating real substantive change in midst of observance. And that's something that we should keep in mind, too, that on Sukkot is both the culmination of the Yamim Noraim, of Rosh Hashanah, of accepting God as the central focus of our lives, of giving our lives depth, like by Chana, of giving a two-dimensional life a third dimension of depth and meaning. But at the same time, it's also the beginning of the rest of our year. It's the beginning of going forward into the rest of the year, of encountering all of those differences and acknowledging that we can't always be in a sukkah. We can't always have God just protecting us like a mother. We have to venture out of the sukkah. And ideally, we should have both. And that's something we should try to focus on sukkahs, to have both of those elements, to have God as the central focus of our lives and saying, my identity is in Eved Hashem, and I'm an Eved Hashem, you're an Eved Hashem, and I don't care about the differences. We're all Avdei Hashem, we're all servants of God. And as long as we're all in the sukkah, that's great. And the other element is no, that we have differences. We do different things, and that's important, and that's necessary. We celebrate those differences, but when we celebrate those differences, it's proactive, it's adversarial, it's individuated, and it's much more regulated. And Mirtz Hashem, through that balance, the Jewish community thrived in the times of Ezra, and hopefully it'll thrive, continue going forward as well. So this is the last, going to be the last shiur before Rosh Hashanah, before our Perek Ches of Nehemiah. I want to wish you all a Ksiva Chesima Tova. It was a beautiful, and I very much enjoyed this opportunity to learn with you all. I welcome feedback, both in person or through email or calling, if you have any feedback. And also, I think after the Yomim Tovim, the shul wanted me to do specific programming or initiatives at night for the unprofessional community. But just because I do that, it doesn't mean that I can't do things for the rest of the shul too. And I would like to continue. And if there is an interest in learning or something else, please reach out. And I would love to continue to do something. And whether it's a shiur, if you have any particular suggestions or something else, please be vocal. All right, I will stop the recording.